Welcome to Croxley Green Baptist Church Sermon Podcast.
If you look there, I've taken this picture from the newspaper a couple of weeks ago. It says, New Year, New You. Make 2019 your best year yet. And this was the title of a workshop that was advertised in The Guardian. And you could go to it a couple of years ago. And it promised, and I quote, because you probably can't read the print there, the ultimate day of talks on transforming your body and mind in the new year, learning how to shake up your eating habits and exercise, set goals and make decisions and boost your motivation and happiness. Well, that's a lot of promises for just one day. Let's see if we can go here. At the start of a new year, many people, including perhaps some of you, make resolutions. Maybe to lose weight or exercise more, have less stress in your life, set goals. And it's not surprising because it's everywhere in the media. In fact, I drove past, you know, the beauty shop at the Topshops, and that had New Year, New You in it. You can see it everywhere. The gym membership blossoms in January. And if you go on Google, apparently the searches for gym membership go up about 40% from about December to January. And even the government this year chose to reveal its new 10-year plan for the health service on the 7th of January. Now, this isn't new, because I read recently, when I was looking up about New Year's resolution, that the Babylonians were actually the first people to make these 4,000 years ago. And whilst they weren't in January, it does seem as if there is something in the human psyche that actually does long for a fresh start. So in this passage in Ephesians 4, Paul emphasizes the need for us all to change and to be renewed, to have what we've called here a new idea. Now, if in fact you look at verse 17, which is right at the beginning, he doesn't make this optional. He actually insists on it. Some translations actually replace this word by using the word warn or order, but the message here is clear. It isn't optional. It's fundamental to who we are as Christians, because they, the Ephesians, and we are told to put off the old self and to put on the new self. In the same way that a plant, like this lovely pussy willow here, loses its leaves in the autumn and then it reclothes itself in spring. And Paul tells us that in putting on this new self, this is what we've been taught in accordance with the truth that is in Jesus. This theme of newness is something which is present throughout the whole of the Bible, not just the New Testament. And if you actually just look up newness in the Bible, you see masses and masses of examples of it. I mean, just a few from the Old Testament. Isaiah, for example, he says, forget the former things, do not dwell on the past. See, I am doing a new thing. Ezekiel promised that God will give the Jews, obviously, an undivided heart and put a new spirit in them. And Jeremiah told them that the days would be coming when he would make a new covenant. And of course, the writer of Hebrews refers to this, explaining that Jesus is the mediator of it. God is already in the business of making things new. If you go back to the beginning of chapter 4, so if you look at verse 1, it says, Paul has already urged, again, it's a really strong word, urged the Ephesian church to live a life worthy of the calling that they have received and work together in unity and peace, using the different talents and gifts they have received so that the body of Christ may be built up. That's in verse 12. And Lisa talked about how we may do some of those things last week. But this second part of chapter 4 becomes much more personal. I think Brian actually did say it's much more focused on individual people. And there's a lot more in terms of referring to the self. Paul also, if you look at verse 25, he refers to each one of you. And he speaks of being kind and compassionate to one another, forgiving each other in verse 32, all of which suggest that he's speaking to them much more individually. So, how then do we put on this new self? Well, Paul starts with our thoughts, and actually he spends proportionately a lot more time in this passage on thoughts than he does on words and actions, even though they are obviously all intertwined. So when I did a little bit of research about this passage, about what other people thought about it, so that I didn't miss anything important out, most commentators spend a lot of time on the last section in it, where it lists all the actions to avoid. I'll just go through those. We've heard them already. Bitterness, rage and anger, brawling and slander, along with every form of malice. Now, I'm not sure, and in fact, I very much doubt that anyone here has actually been guilty of brawling. And obviously, you may tell me later, but anyway. But I expect we've all felt very angry and bitter at times. And I'm sure we've all, from time to time, been responsible for gossiping about others, sometimes justifying it on the pretext of sharing something for prayer. Now, anger in itself is not wrong, because if you look at verse 26 here, it says we're clearly expected to feel righteous anger when we look at the world around us and we see destruction, conflict and suffering. But we shouldn't allow this to lead us into sin or to continue to let it fester. Don't let the sun go down while you're still angry. Instead, it should be something which calls us to action. To quote Micah, to act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with our God. However, Paul's assumption is that if we think correctly, then our words and actions will be more righteous and holy. And the verse that I just kept on coming back to when reading this passage was to be made new in the attitude of your minds. That's, I think, the main thing, if you don't remember anything else about what I've said today, to be made new in the attitude of your minds. But can you, in the words of an old saying, teach an old dog new tricks? Now, obviously I come from the world of education, and I am a little bit aware of things to do with the brain and the impact of the brain on how we think. And just recently, there's been a lot of research on the plasticity, what's called the plasticity of the brain. It's difficult to say that. That's the ability of the brain to actually change. So it can modify its actual structure and also what it actually does in response to changes within the body or the external environment. Now, I am not a scientist. I've got an O-level in biology, but I am not in any manner of means a neuroscientist. And I think probably even the people that work in those fields actually don't, I mean, obviously they don't fully understand how the brain works. But it is interesting if you think about the way in which people can recover some, if not all, of their ability to move or to speak or to see following a stroke or a brain injury. Not completely necessarily, but some of those functions can return. Similarly, if you look at the world of mental health, there are many people who have anxiety, depression, other mental health issues, and they can now be treated very successfully by using what's called cognitive behaviour therapy. And on the page on the NHS website, this is described as a talking therapy that can help you manage your problems by changing the way you think and behave. So you don't have to think in the same way that you've always thought. Recently, in schools, we were given a lot of training about that came really from America, a lady called Carol Dweck, who's a professor of psychology. And she talks about what's called a growth mindset. Now, for you, what this basically means is that if you fell off your bike when you were little, your parents encouraged you to get back on the bike and to have another go, not to just think, oh, I can't ride a bike or whatever it was. And this is called a growth mindset. And her research has shown that the children who have that growth mindset, the children who will think, okay, I've fallen down, but I'll get back on the bike, those children do better than the children who think, I've fallen off the bike, I can't get back on again. The children that don't think like that are have what, in educational terms, we'd call what's a fixed mindset. They think they'll never be able to do it. They lack that ability to think that they can do that. But the good news is, and this is what is very current in education, is that you can change children who have a fixed mindset to those that have a growth mindset. And you see huge amounts of progress in children if they have these growth mindsets. So all of these examples point to the fact that the actual physiology of the brain and the anatomy of the brain can be changed. Your brain is not a fixed thing that you're stuck with its cells dying, which they are. You can actually change it. So in effect, we can be made new in the attitude of our minds, and we can put on a new self. Now, in this passage, Paul claims that the thinking of the Gentiles was futile because they were separated from the life of God and their hearts were hardened. And again, I've done a little bit of research on the internet here, and I've learned that that the Hebrew, and in fact, most ancient other civilizations, apart from the Greeks, their concept of the heart was completely different from what we think about it. So what we think about as the heart, we either think about the heart in our body that pumps the blood round, or we tend to think about the sort of lovey-dovey hearts that no doubt are springing up all over the place in advance of Valentine's Days. But this would not have been something that the Hebrews or ancient civilizations would have thought about the heart. They would have seen the heart as the organ where thoughts were generated, in common with most of the people of his day. This is what Paul would have thought. The brain, however, was largely regarded as what, and in fact, if you translate the hieroglyphics from Egyptian, it comes out as head offal. It's got absolutely no point. They didn't know what it was for. And when they mummified the bodies, what they did was they got something that was pretty disgusting, like a bit like a crochet hook, and they used to go up inside the nose and they used to pull it all out and just get rid of it. And in fact, it was other organs that were actually put stored in jars and then put into the burial chambers. And in fact, the heart was actually left inside the body because it was seen as the seat of the soul. So it seems to me that when we come back to Ephesians here, the hardened hearts of those Gentiles are in fact the equivalent of what we would call a fixed mindset, an ill ability or an unwillingness to be open to new ways of thinking. But it isn't just the Gentiles who have hardened hearts. Paul associates the hardening of the Gentiles' hearts with being separated from God in verse 18. And there are, of course, instances where we see this elsewhere in the Bible, perhaps most famously in Exodus, where Pharaoh's heart is hardened and he refuses to let the people of Israel go. But God also, through the prophet Jeremiah, chastises the Jewish people, saying, "You are each one walking according to the stubbornness of his own evil heart without listening to me." In the New Testament, in Mark's Gospel, Jesus becomes really frustrated by his own disciples when they start talking about how they had no bread, when he just fed the 5,000 and then the 4,000, and he asked them, "Why are you talking about having no bread? Do you still not see or understand? Are your hearts hardened?" I mean, this week I've been reading quite a number of passages from Matthew where it's very clear that the disciples, quite a lot of the time, they just don't get it, which is really reassuring for us. Anyway, are our hearts hardened? Are we so used to thinking in a particular way about things that we're not open to thinking about things in a new way? Now, that is a real challenge, especially for those of us who are a little bit older, I count myself as one of these, those who find change difficult. I hate change. I like to stay the way I am, really. Now, most people in our society, when they want to be made new, they might go up to the beauty shop or whatever, they don't turn to the pages of the Bible, but they turn to pages of self-help books. And if you go into any bookshop, there are hundreds and thousands of these self-help books. And they refer to these along with making their resolutions to be tidier or to use the stairs instead of the lift, whatever it is. Now, as Christians, many of us might set a resolution of reading the whole Bible in 1 year, or attempt to have a quiet time when we meet with God every day because we've failed in the past. Or there might be another worthy call on our time or our money. But the problem with this is that research shows that it actually takes 60 days to develop a habit. And many of us just can't keep going for that long. In fact, by the middle of January, most people have actually abandoned their resolutions. So in fact, they've already abandoned them. Not everybody. An expert in psychology actually says people who rely on their willpower actually mostly fail. The wonderful thing for us, of course, is that we don't have to rely on our willpower. We can rely on God. And when Dave spoke a couple of weeks ago, he told us to look back to the front cover and the back cover of this section of Ephesians. Now, the front cover is the end of Ephesians 3, where, and we've referred to this many times over the past few weeks, where Paul tells us God is able to do immeasurably more than we ask or imagine according to his power that is at work within us. Now, we've all been called, those of us who've been Christians a long time, and those of us who are just starting to find faith prompted by the Holy Spirit. And so, as Dave pointed out, God is not merely over us, but he's in us and he's through us. He's working through us. And we have, if you look back to verse 30 here, it says, been sealed for the day of redemption by the Holy Spirit. God is, and it says this in Psalm 145, near to all who call on him, to all who call on him in truth. God is more than willing. However, he never forces himself on us unwillingly. He asks us what we want. So he won't change you unless you actually ask to be changed. Think about the example of Bartimaeus. Jesus asked what Bartimaeus wants, and after his reply that he wants to see, Jesus subsequently heals him from his blindness. We also have to be willing ourselves to draw near to God and to call on him, to be renewed, and then to receive that invitation to be made new in the attitude of our minds. And the verb that Paul uses here is not just a once-for-all thing. It's a constant verb which is like a constant process of being renewed. And that's a great thing because, as we've seen, although scientists have shown that our brains can be remodeled and our patterns of thinking can be changed, we need to do it again and again with and through and in God, or we'll fall by the wayside. God is, of course, the ultimate creator who makes everything new. And this is seen most spectacularly, of course, in Revelation, where John sees a new heaven and a new earth and Jesus on the throne declaring, I am making everything new. Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true. And of course, returning to Dave's sermon, one of the ways we can do this is through the back cover of the book, almost the final words in Ephesians, to pray in the Spirit on all occasions with all kinds of prayers and requests. Last week, Lisa encouraged us to find many ways in which we can change our mindset, not by crazily rushing round, doing more and more stuff, however worthy, however good, however Christian, but by reading the Bible regularly, maybe joining a house group to talk about the Bible and our faith, to attend church to discern what it is that we should subsequently be saying and doing. So it's not about doing more. It's about really being and spending time with God so that we know what he wants us to do and what he wants us to say. In Matthew 15, Jesus tells the disciples, the things that come out from a person's mouth come from the heart. We've seen the heart is not just the heart, it is how we think. Paul clearly sees there's a link between our thoughts and our words and our actions. He uses the word therefore. It's funny, this morning I was reading, see if I can find it, from Psalm 17, I think it is. And it's really interesting because in here it says, though you probe my heart, you will find that I plan no evil. My mouth has not transgressed, there are the words. My steps have held to your paths, my feet have not stumbled. There are the actions. They come here, they're here. His thoughts, words, and actions are there even in the Old Testament. So we should make it a priority to spend time with God daily rather than carrying on doing just the same things we've always done because we're doing it for God. And as we do so, our minds will be constantly renewed. We'll be able to put off falsehood and to speak truthfully, to be useful, to make peace quickly, to share with those in need, to encourage others with our words. just as it says in this passage. And in this way, we will rediscover our first love. We will discern God's will for us individually and as a church, and in so doing, hopefully bring others to know and to love him for themselves.